The sponsor of this week's episode of the Mobile Dev Memo podcast is Clarisites. Tired of waiting for updates to slow dashboards that don't tell you the complete story? Tired of manually aggregating data on spreadsheets to understand your campaign performance? What if you could access all the data you need in one place, without dependencies on SQL, spreadsheets, or valuable data team resourcing? That's why performance marketers at Uber, HelloFresh, Delivery Hero, and many others trust Clarisites to run marketing reporting, automating all manual work and helping them focus on insights that drive performance. What used to take weeks now takes minutes with Clarisites. Go to clarisites.com/demo to try it out for free. You'll see why thousands of performance marketers trust Clarisites every day.
The problem is that the distinction needs to be drawn between the competence of the economists and the correctness of their analysis.
Welcome to the Mobile Dev Memo podcast. As always, I'm your host, Eric Seufert. Joining me this week is Ryan Anthony, the CEO and founder of Dirt. Ryan, how are you?
Great. Thanks for having me on, Eric.
Well, thanks for coming on. So full disclosure, I invested in Dirt, I think like a year ago or so through Heracles Capital. And I was really intrigued by the premise of Dirt. And I want to talk all about emotion analytics today. So I want to talk all about using emotion, using the user's emotional state as an input for product decisions. But before we do that, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience?
Yeah. Thanks, Eric. I'm Ryan. I'm the CEO and co-founder at Dirt. I've been working in technology and ad tech for the last 15 years and started building my company about 4 years ago, really with a mission to introduce a net new signal into the product development process. What we do at Dirt is use sensors commonly found in the field of neuroscience to measure brain-based reactions to content and time align it to ads, products, and game design.
Perfect. And it's apropos of all the different personalization topics that I write about on the website and in the podcast. So it's an exciting area for me personally, but I think it's also like increasingly relevant as we have like much more limited sources of signals to use in personalizing content and personalizing ads. Before we dive into the topics, maybe you can answer a question that I had for you when we were first starting to talk about the investment round. Why is the company named Dirt?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's a couple aspects to it. So DIRT is actually an acronym for Discover and Illuminate Real Truth. DIRT is kind of, it's one of the primary building blocks of life, all the organic material that everything comes from. And also one of our kind of mantras is good things grow in dirt. And we had to build this technology from the ground up. So several kind of aspects to it, I guess.
Was there any sort of like internal discord around naming the company DIRT? Was everyone on board with that? Everyone thought that was like the perfect name?
Yeah, I mean, we went through a lot of different rounds of options. I think we kind of landed on this one because through the work that we do, we find that if there's something that sort of stands out and you have to think about it a little bit, higher likelihood that you're going to remember it and it's going to stand out in a crowd. And we're building on kind of the cusp of deep tech and core tech. And you don't see a lot of companies out there that have a name like Dirt. And it's short, 4 letters, easy to remember.
Well, that's true. Okay, so tick off the conversation, start with a big picture, big topic question. What are emotion analytics?
So what we do at Dirt, we uncover what's happening in the body and brain during exposure to content to show what's happening in the moment. And things like surveys and focus groups and interviews, they're great at measuring things like advocacy, which is an incredibly important part of the marketing and product funnel. Our primary signal is the best predictor of future decision-making and behavior of the audience we're measuring. And the terminology for what we do has an emotion component, but it's primarily used to analyze content. So you could say we're somewhere in between emotion, content, and predictive analytics. And to frame how this works, it's important to make the distinction between emotions and emotional response. The way we typically think of emotions, things like happy, sad, excited, these are helpful verbal labels that let us express our internal state. But the science of what an emotional response is, how we actually operationalize and measure emotional response, is more nuanced. What we measure is emotional response. When somebody sees something, we're looking at whether or not they had a reaction in the moment. And that gives us an indication if cognitive processing is happening. And we measure the intensity of the response, time align it to content, and then we deliver the results back to our customers.
So emotional response, I mean, I think that carries kind of like a negative connotation, right? If you're thinking about an emotional response, you're usually thinking about something that sort of like defies logic, or at least a response where logic wasn't the kind of primary input. Can you sort of like talk about how, whether or not that premise applies here? Is that something that applies in the sort of product realm?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, if we look at how we consume content, we obviously use our eyes to see, our ears to hear, our brains to process all of that information in real time. In tandem, our emotional responses help us interpret the information to connect to what we're consuming. And all of that happens in a fraction of a second. And we use sensors to measure what people look at, the emotional response, to see what the emotional response was to whatever they're being exposed to. And it gives us a really clear picture of like what they noticed, responded to, remembered, and are likely to act on in the future. Our primary signal is it's a brain-based response that changes the electrical properties on the surface of the skin. We capture that from a wearable device attached to the wrist and the underside of the palm or fingers. One important thing to point out, there's an always-on function in our brain. It's constantly monitoring our environment for information that is relevant. It's an evolutionary response. It keeps us alive, safe, healthy. And when our brain identifies something as being relevant, this can be like a car door slamming or a sudden smell we don't recognize, or even like a scene transition in a trailer, it directs cognitive resources towards that thing, which prioritizes it for memory formation, preference formation, and decision making. It also allows us to navigate our lives without having to think about every single thing that we do.
Got it. And so maybe the sort of obvious next question to sort of raise in light of that is how are these emotion analytics used in the product use case? So maybe I appreciate you not being salesy, but maybe you could just kind of briefly describe what DIRT does and how it's used, because I think that'll help to sort of like inform the rest of the discussion. But how do you bring this to bear for your customers to sort of like improve the product experience for their users?
I'll use gaming as the example, because that's where we do a majority of our work. In gaming, there's a part of the development workflow that's traditionally been very difficult to measure. Things like concept and character art, storyboards, game aesthetics, getting them right or wrong comes with a very high degree of risk. And one of the challenges at that stage of development is identifying the best concepts to move to production. And by measuring audience feedback and providing it back to the teams that are creating content, we've been able to bring players, viewers, and fans upstream into the development process to help shape the content in a way that's tailored to what they want. This isn't like a one and done effort. It requires multiple rounds of iteration and revisions. In focusing on this part of the development lifecycle, we've been able to provide our customers with a signal that helps them build confidence that they're making the right decision. Eric, you had a manual from Scenario on a couple of weeks ago, the AI character generation product. And I think a good example of like where we would kind of fit into that workflow, through his technology, he could generate 20 different concepts of a character. And what we could do is use our technology to stack rank and basically tell you which of those 20 characters would be the best ones to move to the next stage of production.
Right. Based on the measured emotional response from the kind of test audience, the sort of almost like a focus group that you've kitted out with this technology that then experiences the various versions of the game. So like, maybe let me read that back to you, because I think it's very applicable, certainly for gaming, but I think it probably has a much broader use case. Well, I know it has a much broader use case than that, just in general, like design, right? So, and one of the issues with gaming is it's very difficult to predict. So I think it's not controversial to say that like the aesthetics, the tone, the look and feel of a game play a very important role in its adoption, in its success, right? And those things are incredibly difficult to get feedback on that is actionable, right? So like a lot of times, you know, you present some concept art or you present just an early MVP to people, and you just get their feedback would be like, oh, I don't like that. I don't like the way that you're drawing the pirates in the pirate game, or I think they look too realistic. I don't like that. And that actually is like totally useless feedback. And I mean, this, you just see this come up time and time again. That's why I really disliked using focus groups in early stage game development. I always push back when game teams wanted to do that, because they say people, the way that they describe their sort of initial response to this game, it will absolutely not correlate to whether they would play it and engage with it, right? And like people will, they have no, you can't use their kind of like gut level intuition. You've got to use the just observed engagement. And so you just have to push a bunch of stuff out. So you have to take it to that, with game design, you have to take it to the level where you actually get it into people's hands. Like, just the early sort of feedback and the response to the art style or whatever is useless. It gives you no direction with whether this game will be successful or not and whether people will enjoy it or not. And so there's just a minimum level. I mean, it genuinely is an MVP. There's very much a minimum level of or minimum state of the game that is necessary in order to get any feedback at all that is actionable for the rest of the development process. And that is a fully playable game. Not just have to be a fully completed game. It doesn't have to have like live ops and it doesn't have to have like competitive components to it, but it's got to be a playable game that someone can play on their phone or whatever, on their PS5, and then have a measurable response to in terms of engagement and time played, right? And so this idea of like bringing emotional analytics to that is just sort of bypass this sort of process of like just trying to get verbal feedback essentially from what people's like considered response is and to understand what their sort of innate response is, right? So it's to move past the considered feedback into the sort of innate feedback, which is much more actionable and sort of like gives much more guidance around whether this could be a successful game or just general consumer app or whatever, right? This isn't scoped specifically to gaming.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, everybody wants feedback or some sort of information on their work that they can use to make better decisions. And I think if we look at game developers or kind of, I'll use creatives kind of more broadly, I mean, that kind of feedback that you just mentioned, Eric, it's not helpful, right? That kind of anecdotal, I like it or I don't like it. And that's where we get really granular with these tools. It is a net new signal that it doesn't give them the emperor's thumb, is this good or bad? It gives them very specific details on what is connecting and what isn't connecting with an audience. And as much as making content is a creative pursuit, it's also commercial. And you want to make sure that whatever you're doing has some sort of path to commercial success. And whether that's like de-risking the investment or kind of tailoring it to more of an intentional outcome, like that is really where we've seen our data shine with our customers in gaming and more broadly, like you mentioned, in the kind of app vertical, brand and ads.
Got it. That's helpful. So what methodologies do you use to measure a user's emotional state? I know you have a number of PhDs on the staff at DIRT.
So our primary signal, it's called galvanic skin response, and it's been used in academia, scientific research for decades. And that signal is unique in this use case. I mean, everybody's kind of probably familiar with eye tracking. Eye tracking is very common, but you know, eye tracking, it doesn't give you some indicator of what the emotional response is. It just basically tells you what somebody looked at and for how long. And the reason galvanic skin response is so important is it time aligns the eye tracking to exactly what people are having the response to. And before founding the company, I was a customer. I worked with Brendan Murray. He has a PhD in cognitive neuroscience. We were working at different companies. And we went through pretty much every possible modality that you could use for this purpose. And that's how we arrived at eye tracking, galvanic skin response, and surveys. So, you know, we can see what people saw, what they had a reaction to, and then what they consciously recall or are going to tell other people about.
And you had previously worked, so your background's in ads. I mean, you were at Bungle, right?
Yep.
What's the ads use case? I mean, I think the product use case is fairly clear. Is there an ads use case to this?
Yeah, absolutely. So the ads use case is, if we break down advertising into like the simplest terms, companies want to put something out in front of an audience that will get them interested in watching, playing, downloading, or buying. In order to do that, you have to really understand how to appeal to the audiences. Like, what message are you sending? Who is it for? You know, if you're putting it out there, is it connecting? And if so, do you know why? Like, what is actually driving the performance? And to your point earlier, the industry statistics, I think it's what, 90 to 95% of ads don't convert. So like the bar for improvement is very low. And the upside of getting it right, or even just a little bit better, presents a lot of value. And a lot of companies have been working on this for decades, but these numbers really haven't changed in any meaningful way. And you have to kind of ask yourself why. But, you know, years ago, the primary target was conversion rate. But now, thankfully, it's evolved and people are looking at sort of down funnel metrics, down funnel actions with some measure of quality. And aiming for quality, it's important to design for an outcome to the best of your ability. And that's one of the things that we do really well. Like A/B testing, very useful, common practice. But if you can create a better candidate list for an A-B test, you're going to get better outcomes. And there tends to be this like obsession with sort of finding these like silver bullet insights, but there's a lot of value in defense, making sure that candidates or ads that have no chance of succeeding in the market don't see the light of day.
Right. So you think of this as like kind of the first pass before you've actually invested a lot of money in production.
Yeah. Well, and I think backing up too, Eric, if we look at where the assets from ads come from, they come from, in the gaming example, the game itself. So when I was working at Vungle and we'd get these asset packs from our advertisers and they're like, hey, make a great ad out of this. And you're kind of looking at these assets and you're like, not a lot I can do here. That was part of the reason that we were focusing upstream on the development of the content itself, because better kind of core content makes it easier to design ads that are going to correctly portray the value or appeal of the title.
That's the problem with ads too. I've talked about this a lot when I've talked about creative production is, you know, usually the process starts with like just ideation, right? It's the concepting stage, right? And so it's a bunch of people sitting in a room. I mean, it is literally this. It's a bunch of people sitting in a room saying, okay, what ad should we make? And that's a really difficult way to, it's very challenging to sort of like come up with a concept like ex nihilo without any sort of input, right? I mean, off the top of your head to come up with a totally new, first of all, it's just impossible. I mean, you're drawing from some inputs just subconsciously, but that's really challenging. That's where I think generative AI can sort of like create a lot of value in the advertising use case, is just to be able to do that without needing a bunch of people just sitting around in a room brainstorming, because it can draw from just a lot more of these inputs. Now there's obviously risks to that too, and that is it's honing in on like the prevailing themes and not actually discovering new stuff. But anyway, that's an aside. So to do that is really challenging. So you have this concepting stage, and then you go to the production phase, and the ad might be a short form video, it might be a static or whatever, it might be an animation, and then you go to the testing phase, right? And so you're talking, I mean, it's not just the cost, which is, it can be significant, but it's the time, it's the turnaround time on all that. Right. So like if you've got an ad production meeting on Monday and it's the concepting meeting, and then you need to take the concepts, you come up with a bunch of concepts, maybe you put them in a spreadsheet, you maybe reprioritize them. And some of that is based on performance from the last week or whatever, but now you've got the spreadsheet with the concepts that you want to make ads from. So, okay. So you pass that to a production manager, they make wireframes or just outline it. Right. And then they pass that to the production team. The production team goes and they make the ad, and then they send that back. So that could easily be a week. Then you're going into testing. And so maybe the testing's pretty quick, but you know, generally there's a couple of rounds. You do the first round where you're just killing off the obvious non-performers. And then you do the second round where you're trying to like assess if you've got any actual winners. Right. And then you graduate the winners into your ad set. Right. So like this could be a 2-week process. Right. And so, and all of that is done without any sort of data feedback. I mean, until you get to the very latest stage, right? And so you're just doing all of this, you're progressing with this entire process without any sort of feedback until you get the ad in front of the user and see if they click or don't click. And if they click and then purchase, right?
Well, then you got to tack more time on there if you want to get a look at quality, right? So you're extending that window out even further, which, I mean, end to end, we're talking about like 4 weeks, right?
Right, exactly. And that's why, so I put together this creative framework a while back. It's on the, I can't remember what the name of the post is called. How to deploy ad creative at scale or something like that on Mobile Dev Memo. But it's talking about, okay, like, well, if you generally, like the way that you scale spend is you just get more and more creative. You got to get the creative performance up, right? It allows you to unlock additional spend. And so if you're talking about like a 2-week cycle or a 4-week cycle from start to finish, from, okay, here's an idea to like, we've got this scaled in our ad account because we've gone through testing, well, then you're just always doing this process, and the data comes like a month later, right? And if you think like, well, you need to scale, so you're just kind of constantly growing that sort of production volume, you're doing it with this tremendous lag, right? And none of which is really informed by much data until the very last stage of it, until the deployment stage.
You know, that was exactly one of the like original issues that we were trying to address back on Vungle Creative Labs. One, are there sort of top level insights here, or like best practices that we can identify that are just sort of great frameworks for, say, creating video ads? And that can be putting certain things in the first kind of quartile of the video, the first 5 to 10 seconds, but it gets really sort of nuanced from there. And I'm glad you brought this up, because we do a lot of this type of testing. And one of the things that kind of funnels into the ideation is every time that we do a test on whether it's ads or it's characters, we include competitors. So we can see within a test or a particular piece of content or set of content, bright spots. Like we can see that, like, hey, maybe we should take this thing that happened in a competitor ad at seconds 15 through 19. What is actually happening here? And can we incorporate that into our next sort of idea and what we're going to actually put into practice? So that's an incredibly powerful thing. And obviously this is a podcast and I'll do my best to explain how this looks, but with our device, we can create an emotional trace across the content. So we can see when the audience is an aggregate or even on an individual basis, respond to certain elements higher or lower. And when we break that out into different like sort of demographics or audience groups, we see similarities and we see differences. And that level of granularity from a creator standpoint, it gives you a lot more freedom to experiment, but not in a way that's like spray and pray. It's more sort of targeted to designing for the best outcome.
So what kind of companies, I mean, you talked about the gaming use case, but what other types of companies have you seen benefit the most from using emotion analytics to drive outcomes?
We've done a considerable amount of work in social, looking at sort of creative differences across different channels. We have a product we call Sandbox, in line with the dirt naming convention. And it emulates the top four social media platforms. And the reason we built that is we can test all of these things in isolation, test the content by itself. But our customers wanted to see what are like the sort of differences in audience response when the experience is different. So we built that as a standalone tool where we can introduce ads and essentially pre-test them before they go to market or they're launched. And we do see very different outcomes, because if you think about something like TikTok, right, it's full screen video compared to like Instagram or Facebook, those subtle differences in the user interface and the way that you kind of interact with those platforms, it does affect how the content is consumed and how people respond to it emotionally and the things that they pay attention to.
Got it. I mean, I think it's kind of raised an important point. How do you test this? So I guess it's just kind of sequentially over time, or I mean, do you have like, I guess you could just have the variant that whatever treatment wouldn't have utilized this feedback and then the treatment that does and just see which performs better. Like, how do you test this?
Yeah. So we can populate all of these emulators with just publicly available content, and then we'll randomize the order, we'll randomize the ad exposure. And because there's things that you sort of have to like consider in the study design to make sure that you're not biasing the results by the order and specific types of content. So like we try to like kind of build in a pretty diverse mix of content and yeah, show certain ads to certain people and then kind of combine them into an aggregate exposure.
Got it. I think a good name for a product would be like Blossom or Grow, right? That sort of aligns with the dirt theme.
Yep.
But you know, maybe positions it in more of a positive light. Although you could test it. You could use dirt to test it.
That might be our next product, Eric.
Yeah. Okay. So emotional state or response is not PII, but have you found that users are receptive to these types of signals being used to drive product decisions? I mean, I guess it would be invisible to the user, right? But what I mean, have you sort of encountered any sort of pushback on this?
No, actually, but it's a good question. By design, we don't collect PII in any form. We just collect the content or collect the signal time aligned to the content. We do get some, obviously there's like demographic data, but absolutely no PII. And this was actually going back to like 2015, I spent a couple of years looking at third-party data available from a lot of the big data brokerages. And it was clear back then that device IDs were going away at some point. The data that was brokered kind of behind the scenes, often like unbeknownst to the individual and the price that it was going for, they were all kind of warning signs. And we're talking about like deterministic data with PII involved. And that was one of the original sort of inspirations for exploring what we're now building at Dirt. Targeting and privacy and attribution were going to become more challenging. The creative had to do more of the heavy lifting. And I think the question that raises is, well, how, right? How do we get sharper on what the key drivers are behind the performance of ads? And the creative is what people interact with, right? It's what they see and it's what they feel and experience. And yeah, it has to do more of the heavy lifting in a kind of a privacy first environment.
And I mean, I guess in this case, the subject who's going through the process of having this data collected or this feedback collected is consented. I mean, it's not happening. It's not happening unbeknownst to them, right? They've got the device strapped to their body. So can you tell me, are these types of signals mostly used in automated personalization, or are these really going into like big sweeping design decisions? So like let's start with the gaming concept, because I think it's fairly like, it's really easy to understand. So let's say you go through this process, you collect the data, you sort of present it to the game team. Is there a way to internalize that into like some automated personalization that happens in the game? For instance, like, I don't know, call it when to introduce competition into the game. Let's say that was something that the game team was struggling with. Like if we introduce it too early, it might induce churn because people think, oh, this is a competitive game. I'm not ready for this. It's too stressful. I'm going to churn out. But it would better retain the users who were there to compete, and maybe they were going to be the most engaged anyway. So they're struggling with this decision. And so you really want, like, that's a piece of feedback that would be very hard to sort of receive from the user just based on their interpretation of how they would like to play the game. I mean, I think they would sort of send you down the wrong path if you use that as a decision, or if you use that as an input into a design decision. But it feels like the kind of like emotional response would be a good one, right? Because you could say, yeah, I'm stressed out. This is stressful. I'm going to churn out of this game, right? So let's say that you did that. You went through that process. You presented this to the game team. Is that just like a one and done decision, or could that be automated in some way? Could you break these users down into groups and say, hey, in the game, let's determine that this user is part of this emotional category, and so they should see the competition in this way, and so we actually kind of automate it in that way? How could this be used? How could this feedback be used?
Yeah, I mean, there's a very clear path for us to personalization. Where we've been focused is sort of on tailoring these experiences to audience or different audience groups. And when we test things like first-time user experience and live gameplay, which are by far the most complicated types of work that we do, looking at things like how effective and fluid is the onboarding experience across hundreds of people. And the reason this is so complicated is because every individual's experience is unique. If, say, 300 people are looking at the same piece of content and having a reaction, that content is the same. But when you're looking at first-time user experience and live gameplay, we look at it on the individual level, but then we also look at the trends in aggregate. And a lot of the testing that we've done on first-time user experience in gameplay, we also will ingest telemetry data. And so we can time align what the game data to the responses. And we can see things like, is the first-time user experience providing effective instruction? Is the UI intuitive? Are the game mechanics working properly? And I think kind of taking it to that next level in terms of kind of hyper-personalization, I think this will come in time, but it's a pretty substantive undertaking. And I think the best answer is there's milestones. Longer term, as our product evolves, it's likely we're going to be able to get sharper on who we're tailoring content to. But in order for that to happen, we have to identify from a data perspective, what are those sort of net new feedback loops? What does that kind of look like in the back end, and how are we going to interface? And then probably the most complicated thing, how does that actual content tailoring happening? And we are experimenting with this now, and AI is a huge enabler of that. We're testing, introducing our data into the large language models to kind of create one of those instant feedback loops for predicting what content will resonate with audiences. But eventually, I'm sure that will port into gameplay itself.
Is there any way to collect this data from the end user without going? I mean, you get the sort of like, I mean, I keep calling it a focus group. I don't know if that's the right way to portray this, like where you're collecting the actual data that you then apply or that you then present to whoever the developer is. Would there be any way to collect this information, these signals, from like the end user themselves? I mean, I guess, do you need a hardware setup, or could this be done on an iPhone, or any way to get this from the end user? So like just to make sure just to get that data collected from the individual and then in a way that could tailor the experience for them personally?
Yeah. I mean, in an ideal world, we wouldn't need the sensor, but this signal is really sort of specific, and we can only get the signal from this specific sensor. Over the last 4 years, a lot of our work has been done in a lab environment, but we just completed our build out of a remote solution where we can send the device to people in their homes. So wouldn't require them to come into a lab. And the benefit of that is, like, one, we kind of get a look at what people are experiencing in the comfort of their own home, which is a completely unique look, but also it just drastically reduces the cost and turnaround time. When we started, it took us about I think it was about 3 to 4 weeks to turn a single test around. And now we've got it down to hours, and our goal is to get it down to minutes and instantly eventually.
Got it. And I guess the idea there being that you could send, you could sort of like group people in ways that are somehow meaningful to a developer, right? So you could think about like grouping people by the demographics that are used in ads targeting. Send the kid out to like 100 from each group, and then you could get some kind of sense of like how those groups respond with enough kind of data to feel like it was kind of significant and actionable. Yeah, my sister is a doctor, and she was telling me about this thing called like the white coat syndrome or something. I think it was white coat or lab coat syndrome or something, which it is like that people's physiology changes when they go into like a doctor's setting. It's just kind of stressful to be there. And so you'll see a lab coat, or you see a white coat, you see a doctor, just the sight of that just makes your heart rate go up. And so it's actually it can just create problems for like diagnosing things, because it's like, well, you're seeing them in a setting that's not natural. And so you're not able to take these measurements in a way that are indicative of this person's sort of like at rest state. And I guess it's kind of the same with this. I mean, you're bringing someone into like a strange setting, and you're hooking them up to a sensor, and there's, you know, a bunch of people looking at them and running some software, I guess. So I can imagine that like doing this in your own home gives much more of a indicator of how they'd actually be using the product, which could be like on their phone.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually exactly what you described is one of the kind of applications outside of gaming that we're exploring, because with the device, it's kind of purpose-built to measure things like stress. And when you're in, say, a doctor's office, it's a very stressful moment, like you mentioned. And when your stress level is high, your ability to retain information is low, which is kind of a problem if your doctor's telling you to do something, right? And there's a certain portion of every test that we do where we'll drop 10 to 20% of the data because there's just anomalies. Like if somebody comes in and they're, it could be medication, it could be some sort of other sort of medical thing. We always do like an over-recruit just to kind of compensate for that, to remove the outliers. But that is something that, you know, in the home environment, sitting on your couch is very different than being in a lab next to 12 or 20 other people with somebody sitting behind glass. But I think there's kind of good cases to be made for both types of testing. I mean, one, which I'm sure you're super familiar with, if we're looking at like pre-release content, stuff that's maybe 5-6 years before it's going to hit the market and there's licensed IP involved, that's not something that we're probably going to test in home just because of the liability that comes with it. But for ad testing, very low risk. I mean, that's a use case where in-home testing or even like kind of live gameplay or designing storefronts or introducing new skins would be a great use case.
Yeah. I mean, I think anybody that works in gaming is familiar with Playtest Cloud, right? So it's like a platform that lets you do, I guess, user feedback, or lets you collect user feedback from people. So they just like arrange for people to play your game, and they'll record it. They'll record the screen as they're playing, and they'll just say like, oh, I don't understand this, or why'd you make this color? And I mean, it's always helpful, I think, with just like an early build, because you could just see if people like understand how to get into the game, right? Like, can they find the play button? Like, that's important. And you can't do it because, well, you built it. And you could just ask your buddy down the street to do it, but that's, you know, N of one. So if you want to get like the data from 100 people, the feedback from 100 people, you use the service, and it's good. And I've always used it, and I recommend people do that. But again, you're just getting people's intuitive opinion. Right? It's not their measured response, right? And so it's only helpful to such a degree. It's only helpful in specific ways. It's like, okay, well, people can't find the play button. I need to fix that. And, you know, it was 80 out of 100 people couldn't find how to play the game. So, or whatever, the open the app or get into the purchase flow for this retailer app. So I need to fix that, because it's that probably applies more broadly, but it's not going to help you optimize, right? And make big sweeping product decisions, or even make product decisions at the level of a sort of like user group. Okay, so how should PMs think about the use of emotion to make product adaptations or decisions? So first of all, like, is this an always on adaptation, or are there specific product moments that benefit the most? Could this be applied kind of in any moment in the product, or is it really like, hey, when you're making a purchase, or like very specific moments, this really unlocks a lot of value?
I mean, we've done testing across almost the entire life cycle of product development. I mean, we've tested as early as concept statements for a game, just written text in a couple different forms, and used sort of eye tracking to identify words and phrases that were kind of eliciting responses from the users. And then based on those results, you kind of get this composite of the different written statements. And then that goes into like concept art, and that goes into storyboards. Storyboards turn into sometimes like animatics, or even like kind of mock-ups of the game itself, designing skins, storefront, UI elements. Our strategy when we started, a lot of companies try to pull in a lot of different logos and just land as many customers as possible. Like we made the decision to go very deep with a couple customers to really understand where this technology could provide utility. And my recommendation is really, you want to test early and often. And by doing this, not only do you have better information to make decisions with, but the data value compounds through every stage of the life cycle. And one of the things one of our larger customers told us, he said, I need you guys to scale to enterprise value, and it needs to be faster, which is why we had to build our tech from the ground up. We really wanted to give them the ability to test as many times as they needed to or wanted to, without like cost and turnaround time being an issue. And it took us several weeks to do our first test 4 years ago, and now we've got it down to hours. And we just like, if you do this testing early and often, not only are you like, you're able to make better decisions, but it accelerates the development. Another important aspect of this is its cost, right? Historically, doing this type of testing has been like astronomically expensive. And we've made a significant investment in building the tech and getting the price down comparable to, like you said, a focus group or a play test or a large survey. And by reducing the costs, delivering the results in hours, coupled with our baselines, the competitive intel, we now fit seamlessly into the existing workflow. And we can turn around answers to these key business questions sort of independent of the stage of development in a timeframe that doesn't hold up the process. It actually accelerates it.
What have been like the kind of range of PM responses to this? Because I mean, I ask this question a lot when I bring people on to talk about personalization. I imagine like it's maybe even a little bit more, call it loaded or charged with this. Have PMs universally embraced this when you've pitched, or I imagine people are sometimes skeptical and you have to kind of like show them case studies or whatever, but like, or have people sort of like outright said, no, I will not do this. This is my job. It's not up to you. And I don't believe in this, or I think this is pseudoscience. Like what are the range of responses that you've encountered?
I would say majority has been very positive. And a lot of the teams that we've worked with over the last 4 years, it's now just a part of the workflow and they ask for it. And some of the teams that we've worked with are arguably the best in the world. And again, it's not judging their work. They just want some information from the audience that isn't sort of the binary, this is good or bad. Like they just want to understand how they can tailor what they're making so the audiences appreciate it. I'd say the reception has been fantastic. It's been mandated by C-suite on large title investments. A lot of our work has been on titles with IP. So you have sort of the licensor and the licensee dynamic. And where our data's really shined in that sort of situation is aligning around creative restrictions, which can really be a challenging thing. Cost of the IP is high, the cost of revisions, the cost of mistakes, and it really helps elevate the conversation around creative decision-making. So it's not sort of like the loudest voice in the room ends up being the sort of determining factor of what you do. It's allowed them to kind of center around a new signal of data to make the best decision possible. But I think for us, like what we look for and our mark of success is when teams start to learn from the data, when concepts that they send us for testing, the best practices from the prior tests are already applied. And it elevates the life cycle and the organization's ability to streamline the development. And this is, again, very, very much the case when licensed IP is involved.
Got it. Well, Ryan, it's very fascinating. I'm always really excited by like kind of novel approaches to utilizing data in a way that improves the product experience, but isn't just a function of collecting more of the same. And so I think this is a perfect example of one of those. How can people get in touch with you? How can they learn more about Dirt?
You can get me on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn, and send me an email at ryan@wearedirt.com.
We are Dirt. Well, Ryan, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you coming on the podcast, and I look forward to seeing what Dirt accomplishes in the near term.
Thank you, Eric. Always a pleasure.